Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
As you may know, I love to shop for shirts, sweaters, and sneakers this season. And when I do, I always make sure I get cash back from Rakuten. And it's not just clothing and shoes. You can get cash back from over 750 stores on electronics, travel, groceries, and even gas. It's super easy, and before I buy anything, I always go to Rakuten first. Join for free at Rakuten.ca, start shopping, and get your cash back sent to you by check or PayPal. Refer a friend and get cha-ching for every friend you bring. $30 for you, $30 for them. Get the Rakuten app or join at Rakuten.ca, Rakuten.ca.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Charlotte Gallagher, and at 1300 GMT on the 26th of May, these are our main stories. Two people have been killed and at least 15 injured in a Russian missile attack on a medical facility in the Ukrainian city of Dnipro. Neuralink, Elon Musk's brain implant company, says it has received US regulators' approval to launch its first human tests. As Turkey prepares to go to the polls again, we meet supporters of President Erdogan.
What our president did in 21 years would take others 100 years. That's why we support him. May God keep him from harm.
And we hear from those desperate for change. Also in this podcast, why an Indian government official drained an entire reservoir to recover a phone he lost while taking a selfie. We start in Sudan, where more than a million people have been forced to flee their homes and hundreds have been killed since fighting broke out in April between the army and a paramilitary force, the RSF. The humanitarian situation is dire and stories are heartbreaking. The family of an elderly couple living there have told the BBC that their 85-year-old British grandfather was shot by snipers before his disabled wife died of starvation. Their relatives say they lived just steps away from the British embassy, but officials would not offer any physical help. The UK Foreign Office say the situation was too dangerous. Here's the couple's granddaughter, Azar Sholgami.
It just breaks my heart to think that she died alone. And she died because she was alone. And she's still alone to this very moment. And she might be buried alone. None of her family members around her.
I've been speaking to our international correspondent, Nawal Al-Magafi, for more details.
Abdullah Sholgami, who's 85 years old, and his wife, who's disabled, Alawiya Rishwan, were living just over the road from the UK's diplomatic mission in Khartoum. And so when fighting kicked off, naturally, as a British citizen, he reached out to the FCDO. They sent letters to the UK ambassador in Sudan. But despite the repeated calls for help, even when the British military team went in to evacuate diplomatic staff from the embassy, they were told that instead they should cross over to an airfield, which is about 25 miles away, in order to be evacuated. And that would have meant traveling through what was essentially a very intense war zone. A few days later, the grandfather decided to leave the house to try and get them some supplies because they'd run out of water and food. As soon as he left, he was shot three times. And so he left the disabled grandmother in the house. The family from here in the UK lost touch with them, so they kept on contacting different embassies in the area. The Turkish embassy responded, and then they agreed to go into the house and see if her grandparents were okay. And then they found her grandmother's body. They realized she'd been dead for days and she'd died from starvation. The grandfather, however, is making his way back to the UK. He's doing that all by himself. He hasn't received any assistance. So he's crossed over to Egypt and he should be landing in the UK any moment today.
And what have the UK Foreign Office said about not helping this couple?
We reached out to the Foreign Office and they said that, you know, it's an extremely sad case, the Sholgami's case. But they also added that their ability to provide consular assistance is severely limited right now. They can't provide in-person support in Sudan because of the intense fighting.
Your investigation has also uncovered evidence of possible war crimes in Sudan, hasn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So the BBC Arabic Investigations team that I've been working with, we used satellite data, mapping tools. We analyzed user-generated content, spoke to dozens of doctors. And what we found was, you know, the targeting of lifelines, a water plant being bombed, hospitals being targeted. You know, out of 88 functioning hospitals in Khartoum, now less than 20 are operating.
That was Nawal Al-Magafi from BBC Arabic. President Volodymyr Zelensky says a Russian missile has hit a clinic in the city of Dnipro in southern Ukraine. Two people have been killed and at least 25 injured. Mr. Zelensky said the search for survivors was underway. It comes after more overnight Russian missile and drone attacks on Kyiv. Abdul Jalil Abdurasulov is following the story.
The attack itself took place early in the morning, and at least two buildings were severely damaged after what appears to have been a direct hit. And those buildings then caught fire. And then we've been getting a lot of video from social media where we can see people being rescued from those burning buildings. There is a video showing a woman wearing a medical uniform covered with blood. And she could barely walk. And also, the local authorities are saying that at least two children were injured during this attack. And President Zelensky also has reacted to this incident, and he accused the Russians for carrying out this attack. And he said that the time is our people, meaning that the longer the war carries on, the more people will be killed. Therefore, he said Ukraine has to defeat the enemy as quickly as possible.
And it appears that Russia has intensified its attacks on Ukraine recently ahead of an expected Ukrainian counteroffensive.
Yes, there have been a number of airstrikes this month alone, and it was more than a dozen of airstrike attacks that happened across the different regions in Ukraine. And even at night, earlier today, there were a number of airstrikes that took place overnight. And the Russians were targeting different regions across Ukraine, particularly in eastern parts of Ukraine, in the regions of Kharkiv, Donetsk and others. And we know that the Ukrainian air defense systems managed to intercept some of those missiles. But the thing is, Russians also fired S-300 and S-400 missiles in the areas closer to the front line places in eastern Ukraine. And those missiles are really hard to intercept. And we're getting reports those rockets did manage to hit some of the infrastructure targets that they were trying to destroy.
That was Abdul Jalil Abdurasulov in the Ukrainian capital. Police in Japan have arrested a 31-year-old man after four people were killed in a knife and gun attack. The suspect, who was arrested after a 12-hour standoff near the city of Nakano, is the son of the head of the city council. Here's more from our Tokyo correspondent, Shaima Halil.
Imagine a quiet residential area with houses. There's a local school, there's some restaurants, a childcare center. This neighborhood is surrounded by fields. So an eyewitness was working in a field nearby, said that he saw a woman come running before the suspect caught up with her. A man caught up with her and attacked her with a blade. When he asked him why he did that, he said, "I killed her, or I stabbed her because I wanted to." He had then barricaded himself for hours, really, through the night into his father's house. But this morning, we got confirmation from the authorities that he had surrendered himself. The motive of the alleged assailant is still unclear. We do know that he's the eldest son of the Speaker of Nakano City's Assembly, Masamichi Aoki, but we don't know why he had done this. We understand that a fourth person has also died, described as an elderly woman, but it's not clear what she died from. It's still very shocking when this happens because gun attacks are just very rare in Japan, despite, of course, the very high-profile assassination of Shinzo Abe, the former prime minister, in July last year. Last month, we've had the smoke bomb attack on Kishida that he missed. But I think this is still one of the safest places in the world. Gun violence is very, very rare. And many of the neighbors and the residents have said that we were just so shocked that this happened here because this kind of thing doesn't happen in our quiet neighborhood.
That was Shaima Halil. Elon Musk's brain implant company, Neuralink, has said it's received the US Food and Drug Administration's approval to launch its first human tests after earlier struggles to get it. Neuralink has been developing brain implants since 2016, hoping it will help people with conditions such as paralysis and blindness. For more about this, James Copnell has been speaking to Professor Nita Fahani, an expert on the ethical, legal and social implications of emerging technology.
Elon Musk and his company are trying to achieve a brain-computer interface device, that is to use brain signals to enable people to be able to interact with other technologies like their iPhone or a computer. That's the kind of short term for people who are suffering from paralysis or loss of vision or hearing, or people who are quadriplegic or paraplegic or have lost the ability to speak, to be able to get brain signals out directly to be able to translate those signals into typing or communicating their thoughts, for example. In the longer term, they hope that will enable a different way for not just people who have lost abilities to be able to interact with the rest of their environment, but to augment human capabilities by creating a new way that we could interact with all of the rest of our technology or our environment or enhance our capabilities.
You can see, certainly in your short-term examples, the immense benefit that could have to a lot of people. Are there obvious ethical issues or concerns that you have, though?
The people who would be enabled would be making a willing choice, which is they want greater brain transparency. They want to be able to have their brain signals read and decoded to be able to interact with the rest of their environment, to be able to re-enable their capabilities. The bigger ethical concerns for that population are really, how do you obtain fully informed consent? What happens, for example, with trial participants when the trial ends? Do they continue to have the device serviced, for example? Is it forcibly explanted or taken out of their brains? For a broader patient population and just the kind of field in general, if you think about our brains as being our last frontier of privacy, the one space that we have that we're able to shield from other people gaining access to, the greater the advances in this field, the less likely it is that that final frontier of privacy will be retained.
That was Professor Nita Farahani ending that conversation with the BBC's James Copnell. An Indian government official has been suspended after ordering an entire reservoir to be drained to recover his phone. Rajesh Vishwas was on holiday at the Kakata Dam in the central Indian state of Chhattisgarh. Lipika Pelham reports.
Mr. Vishwas was taking a selfie when his smartphone, worth $1,000, fell into the water. He called local divers to try to retrieve it. When they failed, he arranged for two powerful pumps to be run for 3 days to empty out 2 million litres of water, enough to irrigate 600 hectares of farmland. He only stopped when an official from the Irrigation and Water Resource Department visited the site after a complaint. Mr. Vishwas said the phone had official data stored on it, but after 3 days in water, it was unusable.
My jaw dropped when I heard that story. That was Lipika Pelham. Still to come on the Global News Podcast.
It's quite exciting to be the first one to take this on and to carve out what it is.
Why the US city of San Francisco has appointed a drag laureate.
As you may know, I love to shop for shirts, sweaters, and sneakers this season. And when I do, I always make sure I get cash back from Rakuten. And it's not just clothing and shoes. You can get cash back from over 750 stores on electronics, travel, groceries, and even gas. It's super easy, and before I buy anything, I always go to Rakuten first. Join for free at Rakuten.ca, start shopping, and get your cash back sent to you by check or PayPal. Refer a friend and get cha-ching for every friend you bring. $30 for you, $30 for them. Get the Rakuten app or join at Rakuten.ca, Rakuten.ca.
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, telling the story of the 2011 disaster at Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant.
There is no greater threat we face at this time than the one unfolding in Fukushima Daiichi.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Newly released FBI records have revealed an apparent plot to assassinate the former British monarch, Queen Elizabeth II, during her visit to the US state of California in 1983. The threat was apparently made in a phone call from an Irish Republican Army sympathiser in a bar in San Francisco. Our correspondent David Willis is in California.
This information is contained amongst a cache of documents, more than 100 in total, that were released by the FBI under a Freedom of Information request submitted by the US media. Now, according to those documents, the threat was made in a phone call to a San Francisco police officer by a man that he had met in an Irish pub in the city. And this man was claiming that he was seeking revenge for the death of his daughter, who had been killed by a rubber bullet in Northern Ireland. Now, the caller apparently said that he was intending to harm the Queen, either by dropping an object from San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge onto the royal yacht Britannia, as the yacht was passing underneath the bridge, or by mounting some other unspecified threat intending to kill the Queen during a visit to the Yosemite National Park. Now, it's unclear how seriously the authorities actually took those threats, but they came at a time of heightened tension involving Northern Ireland, with the Irish Republican Army fighting for independence from the British mainland. And this, of course, only 4 years as well after the death of the Queen's second cousin, Lord Louis Mountbatten, killed by the IRA off the coast of the Republic of Ireland. As it was, the Queen and Prince Philip's 10-day visit to California in 1983 passed off without incident. There were some protests, but that visit culminated in a banquet hosted by the then US President Ronald Reagan and his wife Nancy in San Francisco.
David Willis in California. Turkey will go back to the polls on Sunday in a presidential runoff between their authoritarian leader, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, and his main rival, the secular opposition leader, Kemal Kılıçdaroğlu. The president was ahead in the first round with a 49.5% of the vote, confounding analysts and pollsters. He hopes to extend his 20-year rule despite an economy in crisis and rampant inflation. From Istanbul, our senior international correspondent, Orla Gurin, reports.
I'm at a conference centre by the water in Istanbul. Crowds are filing in now, almost all men. Some are waiting outside for a last cigarette, chewing the fat. These are taxi drivers and minibus drivers, and they've been invited here to listen to the president, to hear what he has to say.
And inside the hall, they couldn't get enough of him. With many on their feet, punching the air or raising one arm in a salute.
Tekmillet.
One nation.
Tekbayrak.
One flag.
Tekdevlet.
One motherland, they chant.
İri olacağız.
Among the crowd, we meet a driver called Kasim, a fan of the president's nationalist message and track record in office.
Recep Tayyip Erdoğan, Cumhurbaşkanımız.
What our president did in 21 years would take others 100 years. That's why we support him. May God keep him from harm. We'll support him as much as ever.
You're here today to see President Erdogan. What does he mean to you?
Erdogan is everything to me, Aisha says. He has improved the roads, he built mosques. He has developed the country with high-speed trains and underground lines.
We're sitting with two students, Zeynep and Mert. They're both studying psychology at Boğaziçi University, the University of the Bosphorus here in Istanbul. They met in the university's LGBTQ plus club, which has since been closed down. When you think about maybe five more years of President Erdogan in charge in Turkey, what's your gut feeling?
Scared. I'm scared. We will still do something and we will still fight, but I don't know how hard they will attack. this time. Our hopes was like he will go after these elections. We can still like we still have a chance. But if like he still wins, they will attack us more. They will take our rights more. They will ban many more things.
That was a student in Istanbul, ending that report by Orla Gurin. President Lula of Brazil has called an emergency meeting with his environmental and indigenous affairs ministers after conservatives in Congress passed a bill to dilute their powers. It's the left-wing president's first major clash with the conservative-dominated Congress since he took office in January. Many of them are still loyal to the former president, Jair Bolsonaro. Mimi Swaby has been following the story.
They're wanting to basically strip the environmental and the indigenous affairs ministries from their oversight powers. Now, these basically mean the ability to oversee rural land registry and other responsibilities, as well as removing the Ministry of Indigenous Peoples power to demarcate indigenous lands, so split up and basically make borders around protected areas in potentially the Amazon rainforest. And both of these mean that deforestation and more agricultural development is basically being allowed into these really protected, really biodiverse areas. The environmental minister, Marina Silva, said this move has threatened democracy as well as Brazil's climate goals. And she's really blaming Bolsonaro's allies in Congress, saying they're going to war with her, but also with Brazil, with Brazil's natural resources too.
And why are they doing this? Is it about business or is it about them being still so strongly aligned to Bolsonaro?
It's a bit of a tussle. So Lula is really known for trying to go against Bolsonaro's policies. Deforestation under Bolsonaro surged in the Amazon. And many of Bolsonaro's supporters still view the Amazon as this treasure trove of money. It's like a natural resource hub. But they think that is an economic opportunity and really can't see past the fact that it's just money to them. They don't want to preserve it because they want to exploit these resources for the economic growth. And that is huge economic potential. But Lula has come in and said, we need to preserve this. It was one of his key priorities in his presidential campaign, both preserving the natural elements, but also the people, the indigenous communities within the Amazon. And he has really push this forward as part of his campaign, but he's really struggling to push any new legislation through Congress because of Bolsonaro's allies, but also his kind of project of destruction. That's what it's kind of being dubbed at. Even though he's out of power, his allies are still continuing and kind of thriving.
That must be a blow for Lula, considering that was what one of his main election promises was, to preserve the environment, preserve the Amazon rainforest.
Hugely. And he's actually found it quite embarrassing. I think many aides close to him have repeatedly said he is trying his best, but he cannot physically get through a Congress which is now predominantly right wing. And this has come after last year's elections, as a significant number of right wing lawmakers took office in Congress. They took positions, so making it really hard for left wing Lula to get anything through.
That was Mimi Swaby. A Lebanese museum is reopening for the first time since it suffered major damage in a devastating explosion in Beirut in August 2020. The Sersok Museum is located just under a kilometre from the site of the blast, which killed more than 215 people. Our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher, reports.
The majestic white facade of the Sersok Museum is one of the architectural gems of Beirut, harking back to an era when the city was at the heart of the region's artistic and cultural life. The explosion on August 4, 2020, shattered the stained glass in the mansion's tall arched windows, destroyed ornate wooden panelling and damaged part of its art collection. The restoration work has cost some $2.5 million, funded largely by Italy through a local UNESCO initiative. The head of the museum has described its reopening as a symbol of hope and a gift for the whole of Beirut.
That was Sebastian Usher. The Wagner mercenary group, which is linked to the Russian government, has been in the news in recent months, mostly over its push to capture the Ukrainian city of Bakhmut. But new allegations of atrocities elsewhere have once again underlined the extent of the group's human rights violations. Earlier this month, the UN published more details of a massacre in Mali last March, which is said to have left 500 people dead. Just a year earlier, mass rallies in the region had been calling for a closer cooperation with Russia. Crassy Twig from BBC Monitoring reports.
Large rallies with an abundance of Russian flags and portraits of Vladimir Putin taking place thousands of kilometers away from Moscow.
I think Russian flags have become quite a staple in protests in Sahel countries, a feature of protests against French presence.
Beverly Ochieng, a media analyst from BBC Monitoring in Nairobi, has been following Russia's influence operation in the region from the moment Wagner mercenaries arrived in the Central African Republic in 2017.
The Central African Republic was experiencing a rebel insurgency where the Russian contractors who had been fighting there had been seen to be successful. So people were using these flags to call for their governments in Mali and Burkina Faso for closer cooperation with Russia.
Mali has been battling Islamist insurgents for a decade and it's had two recent coups. In 2021, mercenaries from the Kremlin-linked Wagner group arrived, and later France, the former colonial master and security partner, pulled out its troops fighting the jihadists. Some people were very happy.
If Wagner went to liberate Syria, if Wagner went to liberate the Central African Republic, then we welcomed Wagner to Bamako to liberate Mali.
This is Adama Ben Diarra, or Ben the Brain, as he's often called.
To the asymmetric war, we propose an asymmetric solution, which is Wagner.
He comes from a crop of homegrown influencers rallying support for cooperation with Russia.
What has grown over the last couple of months are an array of groups and individuals who have Pan-Africanist leanings.
What makes them so appealing?
I think it's the fact that they are speaking to a very local and close constituent. And their messaging is very much embedded within that Pan-African spirit.
The argument for Russian boots on the ground was better security to counter the Islamist threat. So what's the jihadist view on Wagner's presence in Mali? This is BBC Monitoring's jihadism expert, Mina Al-Lami.
Of course, Wagner has been accused of human rights violations, and this is not lost on jihadists. You see this heavily playing out in jihadist messaging. So, for example, Al-Qaeda has issued multiple messages saying, we are here because of the Wagner forces. The presence of Wagner is kind of used by jihadists to legitimize and justify their presence in Mali. They're telling the Muslims, we are here to defend you against Wagner.
That was Mina Al-Lami, ending that report from BBC Monitoring. If you want to hear more from the team on this story and others, search for The Global Jigsaw wherever you get your BBC podcast. Finally, ever heard of a drag laureate? The US city of San Francisco recently appointed one who's begun work in the role being billed as a world first. Darcy Drollinger is the owner and artistic director of the cabaret club Oasis and will serve as an ambassador for the city's LGBTQ plus community at a time when they fear an erosion of their rights. But what does the role entail? Here's Darcy Drollinger speaking to my colleague Davina Gupta.
It's quite exciting to be the first one to take this on and to carve out what it is. It's basically an ambassador for the LGBTQ plus community and the drag community, and work with different city agencies and businesses and help build bridges in a lot of ways, and also to preserve the history of the LGBTQ plus community in the Bay Area and nationally.
Well, you talk about nationally, but many Republican-led states especially have seen a serious pushback from lawmakers who are trying to restrict public viewing of drag shows because it seems to be inappropriate, according to them, for children. So do you think there could be a positive impact with this step?
Well, I hope that it will be a beacon of light for all of those people that are in those states that are struggling against this legislation and this rhetoric that is just really kind of crazy and coming out of left field. So I hope that it inspires other cities and states around the country and around the world to take this initiative and offer these roles, because I do think, you know, the drag performers are more than entertainment. You know, we do a lot of community organizing and we've got a big voice in politics in the Bay Area.
That was Darcy Drollinger speaking to the BBC's Davina Gupta. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on Twitter @globalnewspod. This edition was mixed by Daniel Ehrlich and the producer was Andrew Ochieng. The editor is Karen Martin and I'm Charlotte Gallagher. Until next time, goodbye.
In March 2011, Japan's Fukushima nuclear power plant was struck by a massive earthquake.
Stay down! Get under our desk if you can! Cover your head and stay down!
An hour later, a tsunami followed in its wake, flooding its basements, cutting the power, turning the stricken plant into a ticking time bomb.
It's all underwater.
Station blackout. Reactor control systems have lost all power.
Fukushima, an original audio drama series from the BBC World Service, tells the story of those fighting to contain the disaster and of those living with its legacy.
Why do you seek forgiveness?
I'm the one whose job it was to make sure the disaster couldn't happen.
Search for Fukushima wherever you get your BBC podcasts.